everyone. This is Andrew Doyle. You're listening to Culture Wars, my podcast for Spiked, in which I get to chat to interesting people about the various ups and downs of contemporary culture. Today, my guest was the brilliant actor James Dreyfuss. You'll know James from his various on-screen roles, such as in Notting Hill or Mount Pleasant. He's appeared in a number of sitcoms, such as Absolutely Fabulous, The Thin Blue Line, and most famously, Gimme Gimme Gimme. We chatted about all sorts of things today, including free speech, cancel culture, what it's like to be an actor during the lockdown, and why the gay press is so abysmal. Anyway, enough of me. Let's crack on. This is Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle and James Dreyfuss. We're recording this just 2 days before the new lockdown hits. So, James, how are you finding the new normal?
Oh, God, that expression, the new normal.
I said it just to annoy you.
I know you did. and I think it's worked. It's the worst thing I've heard ever. It's so frustrating because you feel like venting.
Yes, I know.
But when everyone in the world is going through the same thing, you know, who do you vent at? What do you say?
Well, exactly. I mean, when we had all those videos of celebrities talking about their hardship, it does grate a little.
I pictures of them crying on doorsteps. I just thought, oh, God's sake, get a grip. It's frustrating and it's annoying, but kind of inevitable. I mean, we knew it was coming.
Of course. My favourite was Madonna in the bath surrounded by rose petals, talking about how COVID is the great equaliser. I think that was the finest moment.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's the great equaliser. It's James Corden and his multi-million dollar mansion saying, I'm bored.
Particularly for me, as an actor, I mean, it can't continue, can it, in the current situation?
Well, no. I mean, it's absolutely nothing. I mean, it's voiceovers, the odd voiceover, because, of course, everyone is going for voiceovers.
Yes.
Forget theatre, obviously. I mean, some theatres I've seen are really trying. There was something I saw on the internet the other day about the Hope Mill Theatre.
Yes.
And they filmed the experience of going in, and, of course, it was everyone welcoming you with gloves and hand sanitizer and sitting, you know. And I thought, well, you know, and people were giving them a bit of a hard time, and I thought, well, at least they're trying to get
exactly
back to some sort of normal.
And it is always going to be slightly artificial. I always think whenever theatre is screened or like the way the National Theatre do, I just don't think it's the same experience as it as the live experience and the collective, the feeling of being with a group of people, you know?
No, it can never be. I mean, and especially for comedy, which we're, you know, feeding off a crowd is a very different thing.
Yes.
I don't know how actors like Andrew Scott at the Old Vic did it, you know, much to his brilliance.
Yes.
But it must have a great amount of confidence in yourself to be able to deliver a performance without giving that instantaneous feedback. I mean, I know you do it for television, you do it for film.
Yes.
But we're not talking about that. We're talking about a live experience.
What's your preference? You know, if it was a toss-up between that live experience of theatre and the work you do for film and television, what do you prefer?
Oh, now definitely film and television.
Right.
Now, the theatre's become a bit of a stage fright place for me now.
Right.
I've entered into that period of my life. I mean, I don't know how long that'll last or...
Isn't that weird that you, I mean, watching your performance, because it's so, you know, the characters you play are so sort of vibrant and there isn't a sense of that you would get nervous, that you sort of exude confidence is what I'm saying, James.
But that's probably the acting going on.
Yeah,
there.
Of course.
I'm acting the character and trying to act not being completely alarmed by the situation.
Yes, I momentarily forgot there what acting is. It's not being yourself.
Yeah, pretending.
Were you always drawn to this idea of playing different people, being an actor, playing someone else?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, since I was the age of 11, it was the only thing that interested in me. I went to school with another brilliant actor called Charlie Edwards. And together we sort of formed theatre companies, and that's all we did for like, you know, 10, 15 years. It was the only thing we were interested in, and we both found out we enjoyed it. And so we did it for our own pleasure, really.
And you were doing that while you were still at school?
Yeah. We used to do it during the holidays, believe it or
really?
Not. We rented the old Cripplegate Institute, which is underneath the Barbican Bridge. You know that, not the bridge, but getting into the Barbican, you go through a long tunnel.
Yes, I know exactly where I used to work in the Barbican,
Okay, well then, if you turned left there. It used to be a theatre called the Golden Lane Theatre.
Right.
And it was a big old-fashioned proscenium arch theatre, and we used to rent that out every year for three nights.
I know Golden Lane because...
That's where it is. It looks a bit like a hospital now.
Right. So is the theatre still running there?
No. I've gone past it several times, and no, sadly, that's gone.
That's very interesting, though, as a young person, that was how you felt it had to be done. I feel that that's the case with a lot of creatives, is that you have to make your own work, don't you, at the start, particularly.
And don't forget, at this stage, I mean, we were literally, 16, 17-year-olds.
Right.
I mean, we rehearsing on the street,
Yeah.
And then we did a show at the Hammersmith Palais. We called the show Moonsplash 86. So this was back in 86. And it was a complete catastrophe because we hadn't really thought it through.
Inevitably. Well, you're a teenager, so you're allowed to have the odd catastrophe.
Yeah, exactly. But this was a major catastrophe. I mean, this was...
What happened? What?
This was... Booed off stage.
Oh, really?
Well, we thought we'd make an eclectic mix of, music and sketches, but we forgot the rule of make your sketches short.
Oh,
and above
yes.
all, make your sketches tasteful if you're playing to a room of varying ages. And we got the rule wrong quite extraordinarily that night.
You alienated your audience then.
Well, we alienated half of them by doing a sketch involving Jimmy Savile pre-knowing times.
Oh.
Jimmy Savile and a young girl. So we were sort of accusing him of being a paedophile before he was exposed as a paedophile, but in quite inappropriate surroundings.
So you're some kind of prophet. How did you know?
I don't know. We just always looked at him. I think we had Big Daddy involved in as well, which I slightly regret because he was nothing to do with it.
Yes.
I think it was Jimmy Savile organising to go to bed with Big Daddy.
Right.
As part of Jim will fix it. I mean, it was just the most tasteless thing you can imagine.
I mean, it sounds like it.
It was. I mean, but that's what 16-year-olds with no one, saying, perhaps that's not a wise idea. And I think a member of our cast actually threatened some of the audience with an axe.
Oh.
At some point. Yeah, because it got that ugly.
I mean, this sounds quite avant-garde in a way.
Yeah, it was. It was the most catastrophic mess.
It's almost like a theatre of cruelty, sort of Artaud thing. Yeah. You just brutalise your audience.
It was.
No wonder they walked out.
Yeah, no wonder. Yeah, no wonder.
Wow, that's very interesting. You've got to have the right audience for this. I mean, I think about when Victoria Wood was doing her first series, Wood and Walters, with Julie Walters, and she said that it didn't work because the TV audience, they shipped in, were all basically just elderly people, and she wasn't being ageist here. She was just saying they had no clue what they were doing.
Well, John Cleese said the same thing for Fawlty Towers. I mean, they used to bus in, people direct from Holland. And he said one of the episodes, you can barely hear any laughter at all. And he said, well, it's because they didn't understand the language, let alone anything else, what was going on. And actually, if you listen to the episode, you think, God, there are very few laughs.
Did you had a live studio audience for Gimme Gimme Gimme, didn't you?
Yeah, for all the sitcoms that I've done.
Yes.
It's always been a live studio. People always think that it's fake laughter played in. Well, it might be added on afterwards, I don't know, but there's definitely a live audience making the noise.
So in that sense, it feels like a theatrical performance when you're doing that kind of thing.
It does, and that's what makes it sort of oddly even more nerve-wracking, because your temptation is to play to the audience.
Yes.
But really, you must be playing to the television people, but it's very easy to get carried away and start showing off. And
of course, I can imagine.
But of course, if they don't like it, they will make you do it again and again and again so many times so that the audience do, in fact, stop laughing.
Yes. So just to trace your background, so you were at school, you're at Harrow, I think,
yeah.
Is that right?
I did, yeah. I went to Harrow for 4 years, yeah.
I mean, that must have been an experience in of itself. I mean, yeah. I used to live in North Harrow in the sort of the slums at the bottom of the mount, and you walk up to where the school is, and it's just, and kids are walking around in capes or whatever it is they wear, and it is a different world isn't it?
It is a different world. Tales on Sundays and straw boaters. I mean, it really is just, I think it's about just keeping the tradition alive.
Yes. And did you enjoy it?
No, for me personally, I mean, I enjoyed the acting aspect. We were very lucky to have a man called Martin Tyrrell and a man called Christopher Deacon, who was taking the school theatre off in a very new way. Mm. So actually, they did leave me alone to get on with acting. I'll give them credit for that. And they were very supportive.
It wasn't the kind of super academic school that said it was a waste of time. Any kind of creative thing is a waste of time.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, I don't think I played any sports whilst I was there. I think they kicked me out of the CCF after a term because I wouldn't cut my hair, things like that. So they did actually leave me alone. I think if they saw that you showed aptitude for something.
Yes.
And applied yourself to something and were, you know, reasonably good at it,
yeah,
they would encourage you in that way. But no, I left a year early.
Oh, right.
So, you know, and I went elsewhere to get some A-levels, and then I went straight to RADA.
Yes. Now, RADA's an interesting thing. I mean, it's the ultimate drama school, isn't it? And that must have been thrilling to get into that. I believe there's something like 30,000 people apply for every place or something ridiculous like that. I might have exaggerated that, but it's something quite extreme, isn't it?
I think you're pretty much bang on. And it's for 20, well, back then, I'm not sure if it is now, but back then it was for 26 places. And you went through a long period. You went through for one audition, then you were invited back. And
yes.
Then you were invited back again. And then you were invited back for a full day. So they're whittling down the numbers, until they end up with 26 per year. So in fact, there's no more than 70 to 80 people at any one time in the building.
You must have been a very confident young person to do that, to go through that. I mean, I know a lot of people with RADA, don't they take a few years off and sort of mature a little before going for it?
Well, they do. And they do like to encourage that, actually. Mm. So I was lucky to get in because I applied for Central the same year and I didn't get into Central.
Yes.
So I was lucky to get in so young.
Yes.
Because there were people older than I. They do like you to go away and experience a bit of life.
Mm.
Again, this is back then. I'm not sure what it's like now.
Well, I think everything at RADA has changed now. I mean, recently we've had the students rebelling, and they actually submitted a 100-page document of demands to the RADA authorities saying they needed to decolonize their acting school practice. And it was quite entitled. It was incredibly entitled to read.
Did you read it? Actually?
I did, unfortunately. It is interminable.
You sat through it.
It's like... It's just something that would have been inconceivable, I think, 15, 20 years ago for young people to be quite that entitled and quite that sort of just self-centered. It's very much like, you must do this, you must do this. And I couldn't help thinking, why don't the people at RADA say, okay, well, you better leave then, hadn't you? Because it's obvious that this isn't the place for you.
It's funny you say that, because I made that point a while back when I sent off a series of, you know, begging tweets to RADA, please don't get rid of the George Bernard Shaw name and everything.
Yes.
I said, I think if you go back to that era, every single person had dodgy views on everything. I think if you go back 30 years in what we consider now, people have dodgy views then. And since when did the students have the right? I mean, if we had done that when we were there, I'm telling you now, we would all be out.
Yes.
And we would be replaced by 26 people who actually wanted to be there.
This is what I don't understand. With so many people, such high competition for places, how can they feel that they can get away with this? It's weird.
I think because they're allowed to get away with it. I don't understand why the principal or the board of directors did not stand up and say, who the fucking hell do you think you are? Get back and learn some acting, or bugger off and we'll replace you with people who actually do want to do it. I don't understand it.
The premise of the protest makes no sense. The idea that RADA is this deeply racist, white supremacist organisation is palpably absurd.
It is palpably absurd. And I keep getting these, especially out of all the jobs you could be involved in, out of all the areas that you work in, where there would be the least amount of racism or thing, is in the theatre world and the film and television world. Nobody gives a crap about stuff like that. Nobody.
Isn't that odd? It's the same with universities. You know, we just had Sheffield University release a video about how institutionally racist and how terrible these places are if you're a person of colour or a sexual minority or anything like that. And you just think, this is divorced from reality, because university campuses are amongst the least likely place you would find anything like that. I mean, it's very odd.
I'm guessing, and I think this is a pretty good guess, that when you have a computer in your pocket 24 hours a day that has as much misinformation and disinformation as information in it, you're going to come out rather confused, rather self-obsessed, and rather entitled, aren't you?
Yeah.
You think you know it all, and you don't know it all. And where have all the experts gone? There are no experts anymore. That's why we're in such a mess with this COVID thing. Nobody knows who to follow and or to listen to.
You're listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you're enjoying the podcast, please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can subscribe to the podcast on all the major apps, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. And if your provider allows you to, then why not give Culture Wars a rating and a review while you're there? It would really help other listeners to find us. Now, back to the show. Well, I think especially with all the stuff surrounding social justice and critical race theory and this kind of thing, that actually facts don't matter. What matters is this alternative reality. Mm. To give you an example, with the universities, there was a study on incidents of racism at higher education, and it was found to be basically non-existent. You know, the occasional awful thing that happened, and no one is denying that racism exists or that it's terrible when it happens. You know, we all know that. But the statistics clearly show that there just simply isn't an endemic problem at universities, far from it. And yet, it is spun as though these places are just hotbeds of fascism. It's an alternative reality that's being proposed, I suppose, is the point.
Yeah, but this alternative reality, you know, isn't just down to racism. I mean, if we just turn our heads left, turn our heads right, this alternative reality is being spun everywhere,
yeah,
into every conversation about everything. There's always a yes, but. I mean, I actually read a thread on why mathematics is racist.
Yes.
You've come across this.
I'm familiar with this this thing.
I mean, it's come to a point now where nothing is off the table. Nothing.
Yeah.
I remember once, you know, one used to laugh at people who say the earth is flat, you know, flat earthers. You know, it now seems everyone is a flat earther. You know, where do we go from here? Well, What happens?
Well, it's that thing of what do you do when the consensus is to believe in a false reality? That's really hard. I mean, that, not to be alarmist, but that's like going back to Salem.
I was just going to say, it's like the Salem witch trials. I was just going to say that.
Well, great minds.
You know, when everyone believes in the fantasy. What's frightening, though, is that it is an old phrase and it is overused, but the lunatics are now, for certain, running the asylum.
Yeah.
And how many businesses and how many corporations and how much the journalists contributing to this and stirring it up. And
I mean, it's definitely infected the acting world. It's definitely infected the creative arts more than most industries, I think, in a way. There's a kind of compulsory attitude and opinion you're meant to have.
Yes, well, I mean, if we're going to talk about that, we should, of course, talk about Lawrence Fox, you know, who's done an incredibly brave thing of speaking out and saying, actually, he's basically saying what we're saying, by putting everyone into little boxes and by mentioning race every 2 seconds, we're creating more of a problem.
Yes.
The message I get from him is that he's anti-racist, completely anti-racist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's explicitly opposed to racism. He said that quite clearly.
And it is quite clear from what he's saying. But if I read some of the comments that actors make about him, I mean, it's pretty despicable. But again, we're back into the realm of, you know, what do you do when you're backed into a corner and someone says, facts, please? You scream something ist or
yes,
something phobe or something. And then you sort of win the argument. You know, you dance around like an 11-year-old going, skills, yeah, skills, I won that argument. You know, I mean, it is so childish.
And what disturbed me most, I think, about that was actually when Equity posted that tweet. They called on actors in the acting profession to denounce another actor for his, let's face it, political views. That's what this is.
Yeah.
So that, to me, was an astonishing step.
Yeah, that was. I mean, I'm glad that was sorted out and they backtracked on that pretty damn quickly.
I mean, there were some actors that came out and said, I have reservations about what Lawrence was saying, but I still think this is wrong. Like, this is just a step too far, you know? And the people who were responsible for that they just doubled down. You know?
Yeah. I myself have been a target of this denouncing and losing a job over signing a letter, you know, asking for a respectful debate with Stonewall.
I actually read the letter and I thought, you know, this was just a group of people saying there's obviously an issue at the moment with the trans debate and a perceived conflict between gender critical feminists and a certain portion of trans activists, and we would like to have a discussion without being called bigots. Was that basically what the letter was saying?
That was in essence the entire letter, asking for a respectful debate.
Yes.
And we were told no debate. Fuck off, TERFs, basically.
Right.
And as a result of that, and as a result, I'm assuming, of my, you know, once the trolls descended on me, of my fighting back online and fighting back quite publicly.
Yes.
I was, dropped from this particular company. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, because they're due to release a audio CD of all the people who have played a certain character.
Yes.
And I think I have been erased. Now, I'm waiting.
Interesting.
To see whether that has happened. Because, number one, fine. You want to lose your balls and fire me? Fire me for something I reasonably said. I say to people all the time, I don't lock my tweets. I said, go through my tweets and find me an example.
Yes.
Find me one example. They never can.
Because it won't be there.
Because it's not there, and it never has been there. But it's the same as J.K. Rowling. And I'm not comparing myself to J.K. or what J.K. is going through at the moment. But again, find me the hurtful statements. Find me the hate.
Yes.
It isn't there. It doesn't exist. And this is the point.
You forget, James, cancel culture doesn't exist. It's just a right-wing myth. That's what they tell us, isn't it?
Yes.
And yet you've lost work for an opinion. So maybe, I don't know, that's confusing, isn't it?
I don't know. It is confusing. But again, you see, I've made this point before, and people go, there's always a yes, but. So but could be anything.
Well, the but is holding, the people who say cancel culture doesn't exist are claiming that they're merely holding powerful people to account for their opinions, and they're not used to it. So, but the problem here is that they're holding you to account for opinions you haven't expressed.
But this is it. You don't even have to express an opinion on one particular thing. You can express an opinion, but they judge you also by what you leave out. For instance, I make a post saying, oh God, I love dogs. Dogs make my day. And there will be someone, guaranteed, there will be someone who's going, oh, so guess that means you hate cats then.
Do you hate cats, James? Is that what this is about?
No, I love cats. I just didn't happen to mention them in the same sentence that I mentioned dog. But that doesn't seem to make any difference. You know, I've noticed you haven't posted about this particular subject this week, James. Am I to assume from this that you feel this way about that?
Yes.
Well, no, I just, that's another argument. That's another way they present arguments.
Well, it's funny you say that, because a very good friend of mine who's an actor was contacted by her agent because she hadn't posted in support of Black Lives Matter on Twitter. And they said, you've got to do this. They said, you don't have a choice here. If you want to get cast in anything, you've got to do it. And I mentioned this in an article, and I was bombarded by people saying, oh, that clearly didn't happen. You've made this up. I have no reason to make this up. And they said, well, why didn't you mention her name then? Well, for obvious reasons. That's the whole point. That's the whole point, is that she, I just think it is this kind of culture of conformity. And I think what you said is exactly right. You hit on it when you said your crime, in fact, isn't so much the stuff they claim you've said, which you haven't said. The crime is not capitulating to them. The crime is standing up for yourself, isn't it? That's what they don't
want. That's right. That's what they don't want. It's the fighting back.
Yeah.
And the fighting back can then be turned, you see, into the perfect. See, I mean, we've seen a particular doctor on Twitter recently announce, I'm going to have to withdraw because of the level of viciousness coming my way. I mean, this is a man who consistently stirred up hatred and nastiness and vile behavior.
Yes.
And is now playing the victim. You know, again, this is another, it's a tactic we can all see through, but it's a tactic that works. It's the other TRAs will get wound up like wasps and come off and say, see how he was bullied. It's the bully in the playground who, goes over and cuts himself on a wall and says, look what they did to me.
Yes.
To me, it's blindingly obvious. And I'm one of those people, I'm afraid, which is why, you know, I'm probably, you know, three quarters cancelled anyway in the acting profession of, you know, if someone says stand up, I sit down. You know, it's just in my nature. You know, I don't like being told what to do and never have done. And I don't like conforming and I don't like doing things without asking why.
I mean, surely that's in the nature of creative people, isn't it? An artist.
You would have thought so. But apparently not.
Well, that's what troubles me, because I think it is in the nature of most artists not to want to do what they're told. However, most artists appear to be towing the line. And that suggests to me that there's probably an awful lot of self-censorship going on. Well, I know there is, because some people admit it to me that they, you know, would like to be able to write or talk about certain things, but they just don't feel they can.
I get contacted a lot. I mean, a lot privately. Mm. And I won't say by people in what profession or whatever, but a lot.
Yeah.
Of, you know, people in quite high up positions who say, I completely agree with you, but I'm frightened to speak out. I'm frightened because I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to be ostracized at work. I will lose family. I mean, what a state to be in now. In 2020, this is where we are in England. England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. How did we get here? How did we get to this point where people are afraid? 10 years ago, this would have been... We wouldn't be having this discussion.
We wouldn't have thought it was conceivable, actually, to be in this situation.
No.
And yet now it is completely normal. And the question I have is, how do we get out of it? What do we do?
This is my big thing. As you see, I don't know. You see, we know this is a boil that has to be lanced. Mm. But the lancing is going to, one, be painful and be incredibly messy, to use a revolting example. But I don't know how you get out of this. I mean, I don't know where this escalates to. It'll be interesting to see. I've been having discussions this morning on Twitter about what I see as a sort of resurgence of the Rushdie affair going on.
Yes.
And this is going to, again, to be something remarkably dangerous. And again, it all boils down to freedom of speech.
Yes.
You either are for it or you are against it. And I watched Macron's speech the other day, and to me, he sounded absolutely sincere about doing it.
Yes.
But I do think to myself, we have heard this before.
Right.
So I think now action has to follow. Action has to follow the words. If you keep drawing a line in the sand and people go over the sand, I mean, we're talking about people being beheaded on the streets of France. We're not talking about someone's feelings were hurt.
Yes.
We're talking about this happening on the soil. Something has got to give. And again, I'm referring to Islamists. I am not referring to Muslims. But I feel I have to make that clear.
I know, that should go without saying. I mean, anyone who assumes that you don't mean that distinction is just, you know, but you do have to apply that caveat nowadays.
I do, because otherwise I'll be, called an Islamophobe as well. I am talking about the extremists.
But this is all wrapped up in the cancel culture idea. I think that what we're seeing in France is an extreme manifestation of cancel culture, if you like. But it's part of the same principle, actually. It's the principle of free speech is actually the bedrock of our values and our civilization. Yes. And I have been impressed with Macron and what he said, so long as you say, he pushes it through. But actually, I have been really shocked at the number of people, including Justin Trudeau in Canada, saying there are limits on free expression. And I would ask these people when they're talking about, when they're effectively victim blaming and saying that the school teacher, Samuel Paty, who showed some of the cartoons of Muhammad to his class, because it was a class about free expression. And obviously the Charlie Hebdo affair is one of the most important events in relation to that topic. So it makes complete sense that he would show those cartoons.
Yep.
But the number of people like Trudeau who are effectively saying that people like him are to blame when they are murdered. This is, I have been astonished about this. And I think I'm actually finding it very depressing.
Yeah, I have to say, I totally agree with you. It's one of the most depressing things. I mean, I was depressed about lockdown, but when I actually read that thing, number one, it didn't surprise me that that came out of Trudeau's mouth in the first place.
No.
What also depresses me is the deafening silence from leaders. I mean, when we all saw, do you remember, we all saw them walking in a line, all the smug heads of states walking in a line after Charlie Hebdo, Je suis Charlie, we stand together, Where is all that now? Where is all? Does it? Does what? Does time diminish it? Does time sort of take away its meaning? And I read this guy making the point on Twitter. You know, let's get rid of this Islamophobic rag altogether. But Charlie Hebdo attacks everybody.
Yes,
Charlie Hebdo is notorious for attacking everybody.
Well, it comes from ignorance. It comes from a misunderstanding of what Charlie Hebdo is and the fact that it fits into a long tradition of abrasive satire through caricature, which goes right back to the early 19th century when the king was depicted as a pear and the cartoonist was actually imprisoned for drawing the king as a pear. And you know, there have been all sorts of satirical magazines over the years, and Charlie Hebdo is sort of the last example of that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the target is global religion. They drew the Holy Trinity on the front cover of one edition where it was God the Father and the Holy Spirit having a three-way. You know, so it's crude. It's in your face, but that's part of the tradition. That's part of the point.
Look, after Life of Brian came out, I remember that, you know, that extraordinary debate with Tim Rice hosted, and, you know, it was between the Malcolm Muggeridge and Michael Palin.
Yes,
and
I remember.
Okay, that was our version of, you know, this is terribly blasphemous. And I mean, you're talking about the Trinity, you're talking about, you know.
Yes.
But what do you do with people that genuinely feel that if you show a cartoon or a picture of the prophet, you deserve to die? You deserve to have your head severed for your body. How are these two ways of life compatible then? How do we coexist?
It's incredible we're not learning the lessons of history. I think you were right to mention the Rushdie affair. You know, I think when the fatwa happened and you had people like, it was Cat Stevens saying that he deserved to die, and various, you know, and it took some guts for people to stand up for him, because when you stand up for someone who's in the firing line, you put yourself in the firing line. And
yes,
I did feel the same way after Charlie Hebdo, is that I felt to not publish the cartoons when obviously, you know, all these publications are saying we've taken an editorial decision not to publish the cartoons. Well, no, actually what you're doing there is you're coward. You're cowards, basically.
Yeah, you're capitulating.
If everyone published those cartoons, you spread the risk. And you know, and to say it's not newsworthy is not true. It was about the cartoons. So
yeah, absolutely.
But we're not learning that every time we back down on this stuff, it makes the problem worse.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the frightening thing, just to tag on to what you've said, is I read the other day that, I think it was a Norwegian editor, or it was a Danish, the first newspaper to actually publish the cartoons.
Yeah.
The editor said, we're not publishing them this time round because violence works.
And, well, incredible.
Now, that, to me, was the most alarming thing I think I'd read all day, because I thought, you're basically saying, yeah, you got us. You got us. That is the first step to the dismantling of freedom of speech.
Well, and you know, you understand it insofar as the fear of being attacked is real.
Yep.
And the kind of maniacs who perpetrate these acts will do this. They don't have any compunction about it. So whilst it's understandable, it's self-defeating, because ultimately, you know, you're empowering something that's going to come back and bite you later on. You know,
exactly. I mean, long term, people are always thinking in these short term solutions. Of,
yes.
You know, how do we put a plaster on this for a couple of months? How do we sort of, and this, you're quite right. It never works. It's like capitulating to anybody.
Yeah.
It's like when, let's say, for example, a TRA says to you, you know, apologize for what you've said. This is why you must never apologize and never explain. Because they don't want your apology. They want complete and utter submission. That's what they want. And it's not enough. It'll never be enough.
Yeah.
Because these people want to ultimately destroy you. You know, they want to destroy.
Yes. Isn't it strange that we have this, you know, almost alliance between the social justice left and Islamic fanaticism, insofar as, I'm not suggesting that they're the same thing, but what I'm suggesting is that they both have at heart a mistrust of freedom of speech and a desire to control those who will not go along with their worldview. So I'm talking about a connection in terms of principle.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I find it terrifying. I find it absolutely terrifying. And what worries me now is I'm sitting here 52 and I'm thinking, God, if I live till 62,
yeah,
what will it be like in 10 years? Look at how much it's shifted in the past 5 years. Where will we be?
Well, that's right. I mean, because like we said before, 10 years ago, you would never have expected us to be here. So I imagine whatever, if we keep letting this stuff slide in 10 years time, it'll be something unfathomable to us now, won't it? You know, and I just think if you want to trace the way our attitudes have depleted on this issue, just to bring it back to the arts and to bring it back to comedy, if you look at the religious hatred bill that New Labour tried to put through in 2005, I think it was, where they were effectively saying if any staged production caused offence to a religious group, it could be shut down. Now, they lost that vote by one, ironically enough, because Tony Blair himself didn't turn up for the vote. But at the time, I remember, there was a big cohort of comedians coming out saying this is wrong. It was spearheaded by Rowan Atkinson, saying free speech is important. As artists, as creators, we have to have free speech and we've got nothing at all. But then now you have incidents like the Scottish hate crime bill, where they're explicitly saying, Humza Yousaf is explicitly saying a play can be prosecuted, a drama. In fact, he was even in the Scottish Parliament the other day saying, well, imagine a scenario where neo-Nazis put on a play to stir up hatred. We have to be able to prosecute. I'm like, do you really think neo-Nazis are doing this? Are they dabbling in amateur dramatics? Is that what you think?
I think it's the most frightening thing I've heard of this new bill, because God knows. Isn't the word perceived in there as well? So, am I right about that, or have they changed that?
They've changed it. So the original proposal was that it even if you didn't intend to stir up hatred, but that people perceived it to be a hateful piece of work, then you could be prosecuted. Now, there was a backlash and they've taken the intention out. But there are all sorts of problems with the bill that remain, particularly now that the SNP are now saying that you can be prosecuted for something you say in your own home, which is straight out of East Germany during the Cold War. So this is, it's massively authoritarian. I suppose the reason I mentioned the contrast with the religious hatred bill from the early 2000s is that there hasn't been that backlash from artists and creatives. We've heard something from Rowan Atkinson. We've heard a few people here and there. But there isn't that sense from the artistic creative community, the theatrical community, of wanting to do anything about this stuff. In fact, if anything, they're part of the problem.
Because I still believe it comes down to fear of being called a racist, an Islamophobe.
Yeah. Or a transphobe or whatever.
Yeah. It is fear of that. Mm. They look around, they see what's happening. They know bloody well that J.K. Rowling said nothing transphobic at all. They know, they've looked up the facts, they know for themselves, but they cannot be seen to saying it. Otherwise, they will endure what, let's say, Graham Linehan has endured.
Yes.
They will endure what she has endured. It is fear. They will worry about their jobs. They worry about their jobs in a very, you know, dicey market at the moment where there aren't any jobs. This is the main reason.
Yes.
It is because at the end of the day, you will be called something that might tar you for the rest of your life.
Yes.
But you see, the problem is, unless more people speak out, we ain't going to get very far.
No, and I think with Graham Linehan, for instance, because I believe he was visited by the police, or at least they addressed
yes, he
him.
Was.
But also, of course, their tactics against him has been legal, hasn't it? It's we're going to sue you into submission. We're going to attack you that way because your opinion is beyond the pale. And I think they're trying to make an example out of him. And I think it's scary, actually, what they're doing.
If that's the case, they're losing because he's still producing informative stuff every single day.
Yeah, but he's tough. He's tough and he stands up. But it's the same thing. They're punishing him as well for standing up for himself.
Absolutely. And also, but he sort of dedicated his life to this now. Mm. I mean, you know, he dedicates every moment of every day. I mean, I've never seen anyone so. But this is the way, it's like Lawrence Fox now.
Yeah.
It kind of forces you into this position where you go, right, I've gone so far.
Yes.
This is my new direction. I have no other direction. I can't go backwards. I can't go sideways. Again, this is something 10 years ago that would have never happened. One might have had a personal epiphany about, oh, this is what I wanted to do, but one would never have been forced to do it.
Hi, it's Fraser Myers here from Spiked. I produce Culture Wars along with all of Spiked's other podcasts. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I know it's early days, but if you think this might be a show that's worth supporting, then the best way to do that is to make a donation to Spiked. Even something as little as £5 per month is hugely appreciated and can make an enormous difference to our work. Your donations help us to keep going and growing so we can keep providing you with new, exciting and ambitious content. If you'd like to make a donation, it's really easy. All you need to do is go to spiked-online.com and hit the donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and hit the donate button. Now, back to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle.
I wonder to what extent that we saw the seeds of all this years ago. I mean, I'm thinking back to when Gimme 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 was first on, and the gay press really went for you, didn't they?
Oh, God, they were merciless. But the gay press, I've made this point before, the only group of people that have ever given me a rough ride in my career has consistently, with, let me just say, with some notable and not forgotten exceptions, have been the gay press.
So can you just talk us through, why were they going for you? What were they saying? What was all that about?
Well, it started with AbFab, and I was playing the gay pimp, all right? And then I went from, you know, high-octane, not realistic comedy into another one, The Thin Blue Line, where I was playing what I thought to be much more of a Frank Spencer type, innocent.
Now, that's interesting, because that's Constable Goody, who did have a female love interest, so he wasn't actually gay. Right.
No, he wasn't gay. He wasn't gay. But yes, okay, because the it was all over the top in any way. My movements were exaggerated. Back then, camp was very much equated with being gay.
Yeah, so you had effectively played a flamboyant camp character in Absolutely Fabulous, which I think was like your breakthrough role, really, wasn't it?
That's right.
And then another flamboyant character in Constable Goody, and then Tom.
And then Tom came along.
Gimme Gimme Gimme.
But Tom, who was different, it was because the one thing, he might have been a lot of things, vile and despicable and the way he behaved, but the one thing that he wasn't ashamed about, or the one thing he was relatively proud about, was being gay.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Harvey was very careful to make that being the point.
Yes.
And of course, back then, you have to remember that, you know, when a gay character turned up in any sort of program, the gay press thought they had some sort of ownership of it.
Yes.
And therefore it was theirs and you couldn't really, you know, comment on it. They had first dibs on, you know, to give their judgment call.
Yes.
And I tell you, if you want to know how bad it was, Kathy even mentioned it in her award acceptance speech at the Comedy Awards. So, you know, it was...
I saw that. That was 2003. And I remember her saying, singling out the gay press and that the way that they've been really vile for you. And then I think she said, fuck them.
Yeah, she did. I think that was amongst a number of fucks.
She's known for that.
But she's known for a fuck. No, she was very supportive. And again, I want to make this point, I'm not talking about all the gay press by any means, but I'm talking about specific pockets which to this day do nothing but denigrate. They're very shallow, a lot of this gay press. You know, it's all to do with how you look and how buff you are and, you know, how acceptable you are. Because I wasn't, you know, your sort of good-looking, handsome young buck thing. They didn't really want to be represented. They didn't want another camp person representing them, you know.
This is why I mentioned it, the seeds of this stuff, because the criticism of you was really about they were unhappy with the type of representation of a gay person. In other words, if you're going to represent a gay person on screen, it's got to be our sort of gay person. It can't be someone who is morally flawed, as Tom so obviously is, because he could be so vile. Am I right in thinking they felt you were perpetuating the stereotype of a camp waspish?
Perpetuating the stereotype, yes. Which would have been, which would have had a point had we not been doing a sort of live version of Scooby-Doo. Then maybe they would have had a point. But to criticise it for that... The whole point of it was supposed to be, if I played it perfectly normally, I would have looked completely out of place and it would have been the most ridiculous thing.
But it wasn't that sort of show, was it? It was an over-the-top panto style.
It was a pantomime where we were basically Kathy and I trying to make each other laugh.
Yeah.
I
mean, that was the joy of it. That was the point.
Yeah. And I think more people, funnily enough, the people who appreciated it back then were generally older people, because it reminded them of the sitcoms of the 70s with its garish colours and its over-the-top flavour, and young people who were attracted by that. And now, I think it's got more of a following now, 20 years later, than it did back then. And a lot of people who said, oh, I hated it back then, you know. I remember Victor Lewis Smith absolutely raving over it, and I remember being... remarkably surprised by that, because Victor Lewis Smith was notorious for tearing television programs to pieces. And I remember thinking, maybe it's a little bit ahead of its time.
Well, that seems to be the case, doesn't it? Well, but then, mind you, I wouldn't take what the gay press say particularly seriously. I mean, I think exactly what you say, their idea of wanting to own it, essentially they were trying to politicize it, really.
Yes, and absolutely.
And I think that's what's happened now, is that today you have things such as sensitivity readers. When a novelist writes a novel and the publisher will get someone of a minority group to check that it's not an offensive representation. So it is all part of the same discourse. I think it's just that now it's exploded. And like I say, I think that was the sort of canary in the coal mine, that kind of thing that was happening back then.
So do you mean by that one couldn't write, therefore, about a gay man who was a killer?
Right, exactly, because what they would say is, well, that's, you're saying that gay men are killers. I mean, is that infantile?
So is it really? Is it as simple as that? So who is it? What is the demographic? I'm assuming it's a straight white male. What is the demographic that is allowable to be a killer or a criminal then?
Well, this is it. I mean, we saw this recently with the new J.K. Rowling book, The Troubled Blood, which is, well, because at one point the serial killer wears
on a cardigan.
Or something like that.
It's
suddenly, yeah. This isn't no longer a plot device. Suddenly, this is a representation of the trans community, right? I mean, that's quite a leap, isn't it?
And it's extraordinary.
I mean, at least you were playing a gay man. Like,
But again, but you see, it's almost as if these people are regressing in some way. But because I've made this point before as well, they deal in absolutes. They can only deal in absolutes, and the other group that deals in absolutes are what? Children. Children deal in absolutes. They think in absolutes. They solve problems in absolutes. It seems that this is exactly what's going on at the moment, except grown-ups are dealing in absolutes. There is no nuance. There's no taking context out of... There doesn't seem to be an adult in the room any longer. I had no idea there were sensitivity readers for novels.
Yeah, there are. It's actually quite a commonplace thing now. And I know Lionel Shriver spoke about this in a speech, and she got a lot of flack for even mentioning it. But it is this idea that, which is very strange for fiction as well, because in fiction you always inhabit other people's worlds. And that's what you try and do, isn't it? You try and represent different types of people. You try and imagine yourself. It's part of the creative process, quite part of the exercise. I mean, if we're going to have that, it ties into this idea that you can only play roles that are specifically you. You know, Scarlett Johansson can't play a trans person. Well, who is the woman? Is it Gal Gadot? She couldn't play Cleopatra because she wasn't.
But then how does this new actress play Anne Boleyn?
Quite. So now a black actress plays Anne Boleyn.
How does that work? I don't know.
Well, it yes, exactly. I guess it works because what they're saying is people of colour are marginalised, and therefore this is empowering, I guess. I mean, why the double standards there? I can try and think it through, but I don't think it makes sense particularly.
It doesn't make, if equality is where we're heading, which is where I thought we were always heading, going to, you know, shows called The Equality Show throughout the late 80s and the 90s.
Yes.
I thought equality was where we were sort of heading. It doesn't seem to be sort of heading anywhere near equality at the moment. It seems to be separating off into different groups, and my group is better than your group, and your group is more worthy than my group.
I think there's something quite moralising and hectoring about it, which disturbs me. I mean, you know, it would be perfectly possible to create a film or a show or a theatre or a play where you deliberately cast Anne Boleyn as a black woman. And that's quite an interesting artistic thing to do. And I can understand, for instance, when Frances de la Tour played Hamlet all those years ago, decades ago, it's quite an interesting artistic choice. But that isn't that's not what's happening here. What's happening here is a kind of a perceived redressing of social injustice. It's not even an interesting political statement. It's a banal conformism to current ethical trends. I suppose, does that make sense?
Yes, it makes complete sense. It isn't revolutionary in any way, shape or form. And I would understand it if it was revolutionary. In fact, I'd be for it if it was revolutionary. But because it is so banal and it doesn't make any sort of statement at all, really.
Yes, yeah.
I find it a bit, so what? My response to it is, meh.
Yeah.
And we've been there. It's like, you know, the singer Sam Smith. Well, you know, yeah, we saw that in the 70s. We saw that in the 60s. You know, each generation thinks they've invented the wheel. Well, yes. No, you haven't. We've been there, done that. You've just stuck a name on it.
The idea of being gender nonconformist as something new is hilarious.
Screamingly hilarious. And if someone wants me to call them a particular pronoun, I have no problem calling people what they want to be called. Fine. If someone says, call me they, I will get confused at some point, because if I do it in a sentence, I will eventually go wrong.
Yes.
But I have no problem with doing that. Just don't enforce your opinions about how I should be onto me.
Yes.
If you want to do it, do it. But what's happening at the moment is it's being forced on everyone else.
And nor do I think you should be able to compel people even to use the pronouns you want them to use.
I perfectly agree. I agree. I absolutely agree.
I mean, pronouns don't belong to us. Pronouns are part of our shared language. And it's the way that we communicate. And, you know, I mean, the analogy I often use is I can talk to a religious fundamentalist and I can say, look, this is my husband and I would like you to call this person my husband if I were married, which I'm not.
Yes.
You know, but I can't force them. If someone says, no, that's against my religion, I do not recognize that person who's your husband, then I have to accept that that's their choice.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, it's been lovely to chat. It's been really nice.
As always, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Just one final question. So how do you think things are going to go now? Do you think things are going to get better or worse?
Worse before they get better, I'm afraid to say.
Well, there's an element of optimism to that.
There is. But I think we're in the dip at the moment. We're going to go a bit further into the dip and then slowly we'll come out. I think it's going to get a little bit worse before it gets better.
Well, we shall see.
On that note.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for cheering everyone up, James, with that.
Yeah, all right.
Lovely sentiment. Thanks a lot. Thank you for listening to Culture Wars with Andrew Doyle. If you enjoyed the show, please make sure that you like and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes, and I won't have to keep badgering you about it on social media. I really enjoyed today's chat with James. He's such great value. I just kind of wish that we'd have had a bit more time, really. There were things I wanted to ask him about that I didn't get around to. For instance, did you know that he appeared in Bette Midler's short-lived sitcom? There were various cameos from people like Tim Curry and Dolly Parton. I mean, how camp is that? I can't believe I didn't ask him about it. Anyway, you live and learn. See you next time. Farewell.